Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
We're back on the road this April with our live show, Cocaine Cowboys. If you want to hear the story of Ireland's love affair with Colombian powder and those who made millions in the gold rush, limited availability remains in Belfast at ulsterhall.co.uk. That's ulsterhall.co.uk.
This was an individual who over 20 years amassed well over 3.3 million euro, which they expended on three properties, at which the Bureau brought to the High Court and proven their case that these are the proceeds of crime. So I think it establishes why the Bureau was established, but more importantly, it sends a message to the community of the value and the work that the Criminal Assets Bureau do in the area. Not just the money that we're taking off, but the houses of these individuals.
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you're listening to Crime World, a podcast about criminals, drugs and the sins of the underworld in Ireland and across the globe.
Drug dealer David Waldron's links to some of the country's most notorious criminals were revealed as he finally lost his mammoth legal battle with CAB. The Bureau won their four-year case to have Waldron's assets, including a stunning mansion in Wexford, declared the proceeds of crime. As part of the case, CAB described how Waldron's associates included a number of infamous gangland figures who have been murdered by gunmen. Today, I'm talking with Eamon Dillon about David Waldron's drug dealing operation and his criminal partners. I'm Niall Donald, and this is Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com. So David Waldron's long-running case with CAB has finally come to an end, Eamon. You've been through many hearings of it. But I suppose as part of it, not just is the house taken, but the Criminal Assets Bureau have laid bare his two decades-long career in organised crime and how he interacted with some of the most notorious names in gangland history in this state.
Yeah, there was a couple of names came up in the judgment. We've only just got, like in the last kind of hour. Some of them we were kind of a little bit, you know, we'd known of them, but like, you know, this is now what was obviously put forward in evidence by the Criminal Assets Bureau in their affidavits to Judge Alex Owens. And he basically said he accepted everything. And he basically gave the CAB what they wanted, and all the assets involved were declared the proceeds of crime earlier today. But some of the names that came up, like Michael DePanda Kelly, probably would have been the most significant. He was a serious gangland criminal himself, shot dead supposedly by the real IRA in 2011. And of course, his partner at the time, Cuiva Robinson, is now Daniel Kinahan's partner.
Yeah, I mean,
again, shows you that the connections go in all sorts of different directions. But he was considered a major player. His murder after that of Eamon the Don Dunn was probably the most significant gangland slaying up until kind of the feud between the Hutches and Kinahans exploded. But he would have been involved. He was connected to at least six different murders and was, you know, had quite a frightening reputation, you know, having, you know, with the demise of the Dunn, who the Waldron brothers, David, whose case was in the High Court today, and Christopher, who also had a case but settled it last year. So, and then as well as him, I mean, the likes of Doughty Douglas, was named as an associate of theirs as well. We know he was shot dead in 2016.
Yeah, I mean,
Freddie is doing life for that. So yeah. That was obviously a target of the Kinahan cartel.
Yeah, I mean, like, it just shows you the tentacles of the Kinahan organization. I mean, Michael Micah Kelly, also known as the Panda, would have really controlled a large part of the drug territory in North Dublin. You know, he would have particularly been involved in Coolock and places like that. He was, you know, a multi-millionaire drug dealer in his day. But I suppose you see, ultimately, even at that stage, he was a client of the Kinahan cartel, Michael Kelly, and people like Fat Freddie turned up at his funeral. And obviously his partner now married to Daniel Kinahan. But you also see those other connections, because the Don, Eamon Dunn, who was ultimately... at least for a while, the boss of David Waldron, was also a client of the Kinahan cartel. So really, they controlled all of this network of dealers. I mean, how significant was David Waldron in that whole mix? I mean, I think it is, you know, Michael Goodman spoke on in the aftermath of this case, the head of the Criminal Assets Bureau, and he described how you're talking about somebody who'd amassed 3.3 million without necessarily being a drug importer himself.
Yeah, I mean, and this figure was arrived at through the different properties that they were targeting. So it's only on the properties they found. If there's other, you know, goodies or assets abroad, we know nothing about them. Or, you know, if the Criminal Assets Bureau have identified them, it wasn't part of their current case. But yeah, I mean, it's quite an amount. And you also consider that separate to Christopher's own case, you know, which was hefty enough. I think when we added up the potential loss to him was getting close to 800,000 in terms of what his house in Cabra would have been worth, and as well as the 77 grand's worth of designer watches and cash that was found in his house. But yeah, no, it gives you an idea that, you know, if you consider that this guy isn't... he's not at the pinnacle of the drug dealing network, and yet we learned some lovely details. So now, we used the pictures before of Darview Heights. This is the one of the three houses that he spent, but he spent 1.7 million on this, and the site would have been bought for 40,000. The Judge Owens kind of said today, because his wife Charlene, his partner Charlene, would have kind of claimed that, you know, a lot of her, you know, her own income had gone into that house, and therefore she should get something out of it even when it's sold by the Criminal Assets Bureau. But he threw that out. You know, he said that she could not have been unaware of her husband's activities, and that he was perfectly satisfied that all the money came from the proceeds of crime, and it came from her husband's activities as what he termed as a major player in the sale and distribution of drugs in the Dublin area.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, like that property. I mean, and we had pictures of it, and it is a lovely house. It's kind of, you know, from the outside, from one angle, it looks like a bungalow, but from another angle, you can see it's actually two stories, and there's four double bedrooms in it, and as Nicola Tallon famously described, a man cave was also there.
I think it was a man den.
I was getting
asked by some of our journalistic colleagues today, what was that? Well, but obviously I cut and pasted it from Nicola's usually perfect copy. Well, it was. But look, I think the judge was impressed as well by the scale of this Darview Heights, because he goes into a bit of detail in his judgment, which is, I think, 42 pages long. There's a fair bit in it. But he describes it as, you know, being a large detached house. It was designed to take advantage of the views. From the front, it looks like a single story, but it's actually three stories because it drops off to a hill in the background. It's a pitched roof of black tiles to resemble states. All the exterior walls are clad in cut stone with granite coins and sills. So, I mean, it's a huge amount of money that goes. Anyone who's even had a little garden wall built will know how much kind of, you know, it costs just to get a few things in. But I mean, it's an absolutely massive thing. Like, you know, I mean, there's floor to ceiling windows, there's internal balconies, there's it's the real ultimate kind of hacienda for your local Cabra drug dealer.
And of course, he did have, when the police did raid in, because I remember we had pictures at the time, that as well as all of the classy things that you've described, there was a life-size photo of or poster of Don Corleone himself, the godfather, on the wall of the man cave. So
it's like life imitating art or art imitating life, hard to tell.
I mean, as far as I remember, when the planning permission went in for this house at the time, David Waldron was actually sitting in Mountjoy Prison, where he was serving a 2-year sentence for assault. A guy had called to his home, started speaking about a shooting that had gone on in the area. Then that guy had left. He seemed to have had a few drinks and ended up back in a pub. And then a few minutes later, David Waldron, his brother Christopher Waldron, and some other guys that are well known to Gardaí, let's put it that way, come and beat him very, very badly inside and outside the pub. And David Waldron ended up in prison. And while in prison, he was in a position to help launch this planning permission for this home. But if you look back on David Waldron, I mean, he's now in his mid-40s, is it? Was it?
It seems like he's around a while, but he obviously got going at a young age and was well connected from the word go.
I mean, some of the other names that have come up in that affidavit, there's mention of Darren Kearns as being a close associate. Darren Kearns was shot dead up and around the North Circular Road. And he's mentioned as a business associate of David Waldron.
Yeah, Darren Kearns, he was shot dead in Blackhorse Avenue, wasn't it, in 2016? Yeah. And he's actually described as being related to David Waldron's wife, Charlene. Now, it doesn't specify, like, in what sense they're related or how close, you know, the family relationship is there. But again, you know, you get this idea, as we often gradually find out about a lot of these gangs, that there is usually a kernel of a tight family group somewhere in the middle, and that people who are family often play key roles, especially when it comes to laundering money and moving cash around. You want someone you can trust, or the people you're going to spend it on anyway. And we certainly saw that with Ross Browning, who uses, you know, as many members of his family as he could to try and, you know, squirrel away the significant amounts of cash he was making. But yeah, and another one as well, there was another a gentleman mentioned, Richard Keogh, who was shot dead in Ballinadema in 2009.
Yeah.
And he was a co-director of BRG Motors. Now, this was pretty much a company that was worth nothing and was used to launder cash. And they would have worked together. So, I mean, it's, you know, there's a lot of there's speculation over why Richard Keogh was shot dead. I think there was still, there's a little bit of, I suppose, mystery swirling around it. There was various reasons, you know, that suggested that he might have been taken out by the Kinahan cartel for something he may or may not have done back in Dublin. But again, you know, I say all these evidence is put into affidavits and obviously given to Judge Owens to give him an idea of the criminality behind it. So this is why you have all these names that are kind of roped in. I mean, even there's even like he's incredible the detail that the judge goes into. And he was looking at, I think there was two bank drafts that were used to put down a deposit on one of the properties that they were going after. And he doesn't mention the name, but mentions that it was a small-time convicted fraudster with no assets to his name, and that the 4,000 or the 5,000 euro that was cash had appeared in his account literally an hour before he went into the bank to buy it. So, I mean, this is the kind of, I suppose this is the kind of the milieu that the Waldrons are working in. Like, there wasn't a penny of honest cash. Yeah. And that was the view that the judge took in this. Like, it wasn't just our view. There was a house in Ratouth Road in Cabra as well. And there was another one, River Forest in Leixlip. And again, they were making the point that, you know, while some of these were bought, they were bought with the equity from previous houses that were bought. And not only that, but the mortgages that were on it were paid with criminal cash. And the mortgages themselves were actually drawn down by using fraudulent documents.
Yeah.
And he had to do that because he had no legitimate means. So he wouldn't got a mortgage anyway.
What was his excuse for how he generated the money? Was that excuse was given at one point, was it?
There was, we heard a bit of that, all right, even last year, or sorry, back in 2022. And I mean, they were talking about, oh, he was dealing in cars. There was bits and pieces that, you know, that they tried to justify, but it didn't come anywhere close to the level of spending. There was actually almost no income. I think at one point it mentioned that for him to have got his first deposit on the first property, he would have needed to have saved an entire year's worth of his dole money, which was his only official income at that time. So there was no, like, certainly from the judge's point of view, there was no question that there was any legitimate funds used in sloshing around in this. It was a pretty good lifestyle. There was allusions to kind of foreign travel as well. And they never used the bank account. The bank accounts were there, and there were occasionally money was drawn out, but certainly there was no sign of day-to-day expenses or, you know, the common ordinary stuff that regular people do, like, you know, with their banks. There was nothing, there was no activity like that going on, which again is another kind of a string of evidence to suggest that somebody, you know, is up to no good.
And did he never appeared, obviously, for any of these hearings? Technically
he appeared. You know, there was an appearance registered, but it's done through the lawyers. I mean, they would have filed affidavits, and there was a good bit of back and forth, especially with the kind of the request for legal aid. You know, this is where we learned about, you know, he was car dealing, and this is where he was claiming that money came for a lavish christening celebration, that they spent $5,000 at the very least, which Cab had gone back to the, I think, Court of Appeal to have an original decision to give him legal aid in the form of a forensic accountant to help him with the case. And they wanted that turned over because they said, look, he's been spending a load of money. He's earning money, you know, selling cars. And in his return affidavit, it came from buying and selling. He says, you know, or he said it wasn't him, actually. And at one of them, it was his 9-year-old son who owned the car that was on done deal.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, I mean, that was, the defense really wasn't there. They didn't really have an answer, but I suppose tried to delay it as long as they could. I mean, I think the raids in this case, like Darview, when the raids would have happened, would have been in the summer of 2019. The actual court case, the High Court action is listed as a 2020 case. So here we are in January 24. So it's taken a while, like, to get there. And in many ways, it's not finished. Like, what happened today was it's a Section 3. So that's now declared the proceeds of crime. So the next step will be to have a receiver appointed, and then that receiver given the power then to take possession and the power to sell it.
I mean, it's an incredibly lengthy process, but it's an incredibly costly process for David Waldron. If you think about, he got to his 40s or whatever, and he had, you know, assets of 3.3 million, which he considered relatively clean. I mean, that is, you know, that is a huge loss. And I think Michael Gubbins, when he spoke outside the court, made that point that they're not just looking for cash, like, they're going to go back and seize these houses.
Yeah, and there's an element of, you know, that they want the communities where these guys have made their money and, you know, thrown the weight around, that they see that these guys don't get to enjoy the fruits of their labor. I'm sure they probably have bits and pieces squirreled away. I mean, like, during the case, like, I mean, they were saying that they still believe, you know, Waldron to be active in the business he's active in. I mean, just in terms of the cost, like, they got free legal aid at one point, but there was a little bit of an argument there in court today. And they were discussing whether or not he should be liable for the costs. But they decided he was. And I was trying to, like, different people estimate, like, if you're doing, like, I have no idea what his legal costs would be, but that'll be separate. Like, so Cab will have to go after that separately. And generally, the prospect of them getting that is minimal, unless they have a windfall, or, you know, so, I mean, if David Waldron ever kind of wins the lottery,
yeah,
first people, like, knocking on the national lottery are going to be the criminal assets bureau is saying, sorry, that belongs to us.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, the costs in a case like this could be anywhere from at the lowest 25,000-30,000 to defend a high court action. And, you know, depending on how many days or whether it goes to full hearing, you know, up to as high as 100,000. So the costs are somewhere. It's a big range,
yeah,
but it's somewhere, you know, it's not millions.
Yeah.
But again, it's not insignificant to regular hardworking people. It's a big sum of money.
Far from insignificant, I would imagine, to most of us. I suppose, and did they speak about his connection with Eamon Dunne as well?
No, we didn't really hear much about that. I mean, it did mention that they took out, like, you know, they were selling in the area. I think the phrasing was something like, you know, they took over selling drugs in the region, you know, following the demise of Eamon Dunne. But it wasn't necessarily that, you know, they inherited his operation, or that he was, that they were part of his operation.
Yeah.
Even though I think we know from our own sources over the years that, you know, they were part and parcel of that. Absolutely. Kind of network.
Yeah, absolutely. They were seen in his company and things along those lines. But certainly Eamon Dunne, he was shot dead, I think it was 2010, was it?
Yeah, 2010, yeah.
He was shot dead in a pub in Cabra. And Eamon Dunne had been taken out by the Kenyan cartel, I think, because of just solely because he'd been causing a lot of problems for the operation. And there's no doubt that the Waldrons seamlessly moved to being remaining clients of the Kinahans and becoming, taking over some of those, that drug trade in that sort of Finglas and Cabra area. So the you see as well, I think, just how forensic the Criminal Assets Bureau can be. I mean, it is incredible, isn't it, how far they go back and what sort of details they can dig out.
No, I mean they went back in this case 20 years plus.
Yeah.
And I mean, and it's everything from your social welfare payments to, you know, what was in your prison tuck shop if yeah. they have to, like, you yeah, know, yeah. I mean, but even the idea that, you know, they were using, I mean, there was various people named now in the judgment, you know, who were kind of putting up money, and then, you know, Charlene was using that to pay for whatever expenses and you know, with regard to Darview Heights. And there's also different businesses that they were purportedly running and rental of premises and things like that. And, you know, you're talking, I suppose, like around, it's 5, 6, or 7 different properties with lots of different financial transactions. And, you know, and they track down every piece of paper of that
yeah.
paper trail
yeah.
and nail it down.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a long, slow process, you know,
yeah.
And somebody has to put it together. I mean, like there's financial officers working for CAB who do a lot of the kind of the forensic work to kind of show, you know, where the money is going. They'll say, well, you know, €10,000 of unexplained cash entered this bank account. And then it goes out through this one, you know, at 6,000 and 4,000 out of another one. And they'll say that happened within such and such a day. So it's safe to assume that this 10,000 was specifically used
yeah.
to do these two things, like, you know, and they trace it all back. And the idea that somebody might have a, you know, an insurance claim and, you know, and yeah. they say, oh, I got 80 grand from a motorbike accident. They'll actually show like where that 80 grand went.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and if you're doing a whole bunch of circular transactions, it becomes clear quite obviously, like, you know, I mean, I get the feeling sometimes some of these guys confuse themselves moving money yeah. around. And when you have, I suppose, these, you know, the real experts at it, they can piece it all together and put together a strong case. And this particular judge, I think he was involved in a lot of tax cases before. Like, he seems to be an extremely numerate, I suppose, yeah. as opposed to literate. Well, he's illiterate as well. But, like, he's a numerate judge and you know, and will go through and ask if there was an error with the CAB financial officers yeah. to nail things down. Like, he's pretty sharp in that sense, like, you know.
And of course, the burden for proof is not this. It's not a sort of guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. It's still a civil action.
Yeah, it's a civil case. Yeah, and the onus of proof actually switches the other way around. So in a criminal case, the state has to prove that you broke the law. In this case, under the Criminal Assets Bureau, under the Proceeds of Crime Act, actually, as it's called, you have to show that your income is legitimate. So
yeah.
the onus is switched onto the person that the state is saying, no, you're a drug dealer, you're a criminal, you don't have any way of having 3.3 million worth of property dotted yeah. around the country. You've
yeah.
never worked a day in your life. So you tell us where the money came from, because we have all this garden intelligence to say you're linked to kind of household names
yeah.
like when it comes to criminal activity
yeah.
and that you're up to your neck in drug dealing.
Yeah.
And you have to prove otherwise. You have to show us that you do have a plastering business or a car sales business, or you're a successful horse dealer or whatever it is that, you know, they come up with.
Yeah, the old John Gilligan defense of I won it on the horses, and not just used by John Gilligan, it must be said.
No,
it's not going to, it just doesn't stand up to that level of scrutiny.
No, I mean, and the idea that you could walk into a, you know, a poker game or, you know, a casino and tip around for a couple of hours, having bought 20 grand worth of cash, and then walk out again
yeah.
with 19,000.
Yeah.
Like, those days are gone, because they will get the CCTV.
Yeah.
Like, they'll show that you went in with 20 and you came out with 19, that you didn't play any hands.
Yeah.
It was clearly a money laundering exercise to make it look like you won it. So, I mean, you know, where did you get the 20 grand to go into the casino in the first place? So, I mean, or whatever it was, you're claiming you went in with 500.
Yeah.
You know, some of these guys don't even have that, like, in legitimate income. So it's a long and difficult road to launder your money. I mean, and we've spoken about it before on this podcast, like, you know, that I'd say a minimum a third of a criminal organization's efforts must be out on yeah. on actually laundering the cash and finding ways to launder it and transporting cash, because they need the cash where, you know, to buy the drugs or to pay people off. And they have to try and keep it, you know, at arm's length from the authorities. And at the same time, try not to lose too much of their profit margin at the same time. Because we know some guys at the lower end, like it costs them 50% just for a basic check to come from a bogey company to say that they're working as, you know, a contractor of some description.
But I think you see now the Waldrons and that the days of criminals buying big properties in Ireland, like they really must be coming to an end at some point. They must start to realise that they're just not going to get away with it.
Yeah, and you think they would have already thought that. And looking at some of the recent court cases or cab cases involving property in the last couple of months, and there's been quite a few, and there's a number of properties up for sale. Like, it does really look like, you know, at the height of, I suppose, the financial crash, or not the height, the opposite, at the depths of the financial crash, that that a lot of people involved in crime took advantage to buy cheap apartments. And then as the prices went up, they bought and sold and moved on, and also had rental income and were mixing up all this, you know, income with their drug dealing or their whatever activities they were up to. But I mean, there was certainly a significant investment by criminal gangs in this country in property when the crash happened. And that's a worldwide thing. I mean, there was some massive figure of something like $365 billion, I think, estimated by the UN. Yeah. And I did double check this figure twice now because it's such a colossal number.
Yeah.
And they figured there was $365 billion of black money like went into the financial system, the global financial system, when you know, that crash happened. And that without it, the other banks would have gone. So there was a bit loose with the regulations at the time, because I think some of the banks were looking at, you know, going belly up otherwise. And I suppose on a smaller scale in Ireland, you probably had that. There was people only too happy to offload a property and, you know, cut their losses and get out of it, that, you know, properties were possibly bought and sold without, you know, an entirely, you know, sharp look at exactly where this has all been funded, what's going on. It mightn't happen now, but then again,
you never know. I suppose as well, you can see the Waldrons, they have to suck in all these people in order to launder that money, don't they? They have to, it can't just be done by themselves. They have to get all these people, probably relatively innocent in other terms, not heavily involved in crime. It is a huge job in itself.
Oh no, I don't think they overdid it now in the Waldrons. You know, compared to some of the other cases that we've seen, you know, I suppose Ross Browning went to the trouble of setting up, you know, his fitness company, which was staffed by certain members of his family. And of course, it didn't have a bank account associated to it. But there was an attempt to kind of make it look like there was some kind of legitimate business. I mean, the motor company BDR that David Waldron was a director of, along with Richard Keogh, was pretty much a shell company, even though they were renting a building that, you know, I think it was referred to as his garage. But that was it. I mean, there was no evidence of any particular trading going on. I mean, that was the whole thing. It was mentioned a number of times by Judge Owens in his remarks. He didn't read out the full 42-page judgment, thankfully. But he did mention a number of times, no evidence. There's just no evidence. You know, and that was kind of repeated. And that there was, you know, and his only conclusion that he could make from all of this was that all these properties were ultimately bought with the proceeds of crime, and they were in the control of David Waldron, no matter whose name was on them.
Yeah. Well, no doubt we'll be back to him, because these things tend to wend their way through courts slowly but steadily, don't they, again? But it is still a good day for the Criminal Assets Bureau.
Oh, I think they're delighted with themselves.
Yeah, and you can see why.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks very much, Eamon.
Always a pleasure, Niall.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Crime World, a podcast from SundayWorld.com. Produced by Ian Mullaney and edited by me, Nicola Tallant. Research assistant is Claude Amini. If you like this show and love true crime, leave us a review, or why not download the free SundayWorld.com app for lots more stories from Ireland and across the globe.
Would you like to be able to start conversations like a pro? Take the Sunday World, your daily dose of what's going on. Do not consume the Sunday World if you're involved in a drug cartel, you're a politician with something to hide, or you've appeared on a reality TV show and care about others' opinions. Consume the Sunday World responsibly. Always read the stories, gossip, and commentary.